You are listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network. OneOfUs.net and all of the shows on it are 100% subscriber supported. Please consider becoming a subscriber to OneOfUs.net. Keep the site and all of our great shows going and get some terrific bonus content as well.
Hold. Cue Daniel.
Sex, baby. Let's talk about education.
Well,
you had it for a minute there, and then it just jumped the shark.
I didn't want to do this at all.
Wow, well, faster than you could.
He got
say
the short straw.
Yeah, somebody had to do it.
Some people are late bloomers, guys, as the show has told us.
Faster than you can say salt and pepper a cappella, the review just went totally downhill. But that's all right. We're all here together. I'm here in a...
Learning.
Yes,
I
we're all
safe,
learning.
I feel safe, actually. That felt safe.
This is a safe place for all of us.
I'm glad we all experienced that together.
You know, so for those of you who haven't figured it out already, well, you already know because you clicked the link and it had the title and everything in it, but...
And if you didn't, boy, are you going to be surprised.
Wait, this isn't the movie I was expecting. This isn't the review for Cats. What is this?
Oh, God, don't make me relive that. I did it once and never again.
Fair enough.
There are not enough drugs in the world.
You weren't a fan?
I did that review. I'm not doing it again. Onward to sex stuff.
Yes, let's get to the sex stuff.
Like there wasn't sex stuff in Cats.
We are talking, of course, about Sex Education Season 2, which just came out on Netflix. If you're listening to this, you have already binged all 8 episodes, I'm sure. So we're going to start off by introducing ourselves. I'm Marco. I'm joined today by my lovely, sexy host.
Doggett.
Woo.
And
I heard lovely, sexy host, and I immediately thought about myself.
You know, hey, that self-love is okay, Doggett. And
as you've learned in the show, you are on theme.
And Jennifer is here as well. And we're going to...
I am indeed.
I was waiting for you to jump in there, but I think Doggett sort of hogged the spotlight there for a second. Anyways, we are going to do a brief little spoiler-free review for those of you who have not finished the episodes yet. We don't want to ruin it, the fun for you. And then afterwards, after giving our final thoughts, we'll have a little fun little spoiler section, and we'll get to talk and dig in a little deeper into the show that we really liked. And now I'm going deeper on this. So I'm already imagining a lot of sexual innuendos are going to be flying, but that's okay. Who wants to give a quick little synopsis on this sucker? Anybody?
I mean, I'll go. All right, sure.
Go for it.
So we travel back to the UK for another deep dive into the mutual sex lives of a group of teenagers and the adults that oversee them. This particular season has a lot more to do with the internal politics of the school and various self-discoveries and expanding of knowledge, fetishes, and educational faux pas in the sex genre. Is, I think, a safe way of saying it.
Yeah, I think that was really succinct, and that was really good. Because I was,
Thank you.
There's a lot of stuff going on in this show, and it's kind of hard to synopsize it. But if you saw season one, and I assume if you're listening to this, you saw the first season. It's centered around a character named Otis, who grew up in a house where his parents were sex therapists. And that has really screwed with Otis. He's very, very socially awkward, sexually repressed, but he's also, compared to his peers, one of the most informed people when it comes to sex. So he and his buddy Maeve start a sex therapy clinic, a clandestine operation, and in season two, by some plot mechanics that I'm not going to get into right now, his own mother is brought aboard the school and told to kind of, you know, help reshape their obviously lacking sexual education program. And of course, this adds a lot of humor to the situation because now Otis has a rival. He has a competitor and it's his mom. And you know what? She's better at this than he is.
Season two, Sex Ed the Streets.
It's really the dynamic of Jesse Pinkman versus Walter White.
Yeah, you know, it's like at some point the student becomes the master, but that has not happened yet. Otis is still very much a student in every sense of the term. But yeah, this has so much kind of cringy humor in it. The thing that kind of distinguishes Sex Education, at least for me, is that for all of the sort of pervy, sort of over-the-top, crazy things that go on, it actually has a lot of heart and actually is very focused on generating a sex-positive message for the audience. And I think that's refreshing.
Absolutely. And it's interesting that though this show is about a bunch of teenagers, it's obvious that the audience is not necessarily restricted to teenagers. Like, people in their 30s, 40s, and 50s, I imagine, are going to be learning things about this show, especially because the current political climate of sex in popular media is so much changing. I mean, we're not in the 50s and 60s anymore where you don't talk about it, you don't think about it, you don't look at it in public. Now it's very much more of like a visceral in your face all the time situation. And the show does a really good job of bringing kind of like the dirty cobwebby corners of the sexual genre out into the light and just go like, all right, here it is. We're throwing it in front of you. You're going to look at everything. We're going to figure everything out in this show in the space of 8 episodes and then go.
It's surprising how many themes they touch on, how many taboos. I mean, look, I guarantee you this is the only mainstream comedy that is going to make you laugh and cry and also goes deep into discussions on anal douching. You don't get that anywhere else.
In such a candid, just unadulterated way. Like, we're just throwing it out there, very matter of fact. It's not cliche.
Down to
it's just
business.
You yeah. need to know this shit, so we're going to tell you about it and draw you pretty pictures.
Yeah, it's not prurient. It's not exploitative. I mean, yes, they have a lot of, they do generate a lot of laughs, you know, from discomfort and sometimes at the expense of our characters. But it always comes back to that place of honesty and respect and being truthful about, you know, if you think about that in the 70s and 80s, you know, every household in America seemed to have a copy of that old book, you know, Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About Sex, but Were Too Afraid to Ask. And now that conversation is actually happening in a much more direct way, more than any of us could have imagined back then. But yeah, as we find in season two, all of our characters have returned. There are some new characters have entered the story. And, you know, but a lot of this story really focuses around the character of Otis, his mother, Otis's best friend, Eric, and his, you know, secret, not so secret crush and business partner, Maeve. We get to meet more of Maeve's family. We get to meet, of course, the horrible headmaster and his repressed son, Adam, you know, Amy and all the other mean girls that, you know, Maeve is sort of friends or at least familiar with. And every single one of them has like a significant story. If anything, the big difference this season, I think, is that it's a little bit more, it's giving more development to the characters. Last season felt really more Otis's story. Here it feels like they've expanded and really given all of their actors an opportunity to shine and bounce them off of new cast members who've come in, including new potential love rivals. Anybody got some thoughts on the new cast?
Well, I just think it's always been the case for the show, though. I think these characters had always kind of always been around. Maybe we saw them more as background characters, but their stories were always more interesting than Otis, and the same is happening again this season. Everybody else's story is so interesting. Like, one of the new cast members, what's his name?
Remy?
Like the one who... Remy?
Remy, the French kid who has only one outfit.
Yeah, the one everybody wants to fuck.
Yeah, but he only has one outfit. That's weird to me, but go on.
British Drake?
Yeah.
Let's not call anybody poor. Come on. Sometimes you wore the same outfit to school.
You know, he changed his shirt, but the thing is, he always looks on point. Hey, you know, if everybody's crazy about you, obviously they don't care what he looks like in clothing. I think they're all more interested in what he looks like without the clothes.
He was clean cut.
He was clean all the way, especially in the anus, because he knew a lot about douching.
I think he was my favorite character this season because he's such a great counterbalance to Eric in season one, who was figuring himself out, figuring out where he wanted to go and what he wanted to do, and having that kind of origin story. This is a character who knows himself to a T. He knows who he is, what he's about, and how to get what he wants in a way that's not at all abrasive. He just is. And it's such a beautiful thing to see in somebody of that age and social dynamic. And the way that he's he is so matter of fact, yeah, it helps everybody else be very matter of fact about, you know, being gay, being open, normalizing self-care in...
Yeah.
He's somebody you really wish you could be like, but then you kind of see, oh shit, even he can still get hurt.
Oh yeah, he can get hurt, but I mean, he's not a guy who's hurting himself the way so many of these other characters are. He's kind of like the gay perfect version of Otis in that he's informed, but he's also not sexually repressed or hung up. He's like, he knows about sex, he doesn't mind talking about it openly, and
he's a ticking time bomb, a Frenchman around all these British people.
Oh, I mean, you know, he's gonna get laid as much as times as he wants to, but he has nothing but eyes for Eric, which leads me into, I think, the next big significant addition to this season. I mean, there was elements of it last season, but this is the season of love triangles. Almost to the point where I found it kind of distracting, because in addition to Remy, around the periphery of the story is Adam, the headmaster's son and bully, who, you know, we saw he had a fling with Eric towards the end of season one and is clearly sexually repressed and angry and stuck in this stifling household and sent to military school because he's just a constant fuck up. And why Eric would even entertain, it's like the choice is so obvious, and yet that is his love triangle for the season. It's like, do I go with Eric? Do I go with Adam, who has bullied me my whole life and is just an asshole and unhappy? Or do I go with Remy, who seems to just have it all figured out? Meanwhile, you also have the character of Isaac also adding to the diversity of this cast. A rare case of having a disabled actor playing a disabled character. He is the new neighbor for Maeve, who we find out they have a lot in common. They're both children of, you know, they've both been abandoned, they've both been fostered, they have lots of issues with their family. They both live in this shitty little trailer park, and they both have these very cutting, sharp wits. You know, he himself is described like Otis, but like cool, you know, and like together. So he's the love triangle between Otis and Maeve this season. Likewise, we have Jakob, the father of Otis's girlfriend, Ola, you know, and he is romancing the great Gillian Anderson's character. And, you know, meanwhile, her ex-husband Remy's in the mix. I mean, I can go on because that's not the only one. There's Ola and Lily and some other people. There's like two or three different love triangles every episode, and sometimes I found that element a little distracting sometimes, because it felt like they had one narrative ploy that they were just going to keep using over and over. But, you know, to be fair, all of those characters, all those actors play them brilliantly, so it's hard to complain when it's being done so well.
Well, if we focus too much on Otis, don't we just kind of realize it's very simple? He's just going through a dickish period right now.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man, is he. I wanted to punch him in the face a few times this
But at
season.
The same time, it wasn't like, he wasn't a mega dick. Even his big blow-up drunk parade is like, oh, I've seen worse.
Yeah, I think everybody, yeah, Otis is that classic, no pun intended, only slightly intended, he's that classic straight man character, you know, and he's sort of our kind of entry point into the series, and surrounding him is a cast of far more interesting, larger than life characters. That's a pretty standard way of, you know, dealing with a coming of age story, is just to throw all of these interesting people around you. But everybody in this thing has a moment to shine. It's that rare show where I don't find a weak link in the cast. Everybody's just nailing it. And for a lot of these actors, it's some of their first work they've ever done. I mean, they're all fairly young. And I think Inchudi, I believe, is his name, the actor who plays Eric, is one of my favorite parts of both seasons. I think he's the standout of the cast. And Chudi Gatwa as Eric, Otis's best friend, and that guy just nails everything he's in. He's written as openly gay and kind of over the top. He could easily go into caricature, and yet he's one of the most engaging and most nuanced characters in the show.
I think the moment in the first season where he gets all done up to go to prom and is just here for it and like, this is who I am and I'm here for me and not for other people, I think was one of like the most beautiful. I just wanted to stand up and slow clap forever. I need this moment in my life kind of things. And he continues that in season two. And oh man, it's just so good. I could listen to him laugh joyously about Otis's awkwardness all day.
And you know, that
Eric has this thing. It's just, we all went through our fashion phase or our own little change up during high school. I used to have bangs. That's all I had to add to that conversation.
No, hey, you know, we've all done it. I briefly tried hats, and I realized very quickly, hats don't work for me. You do crazy shit like that when you're a kid. You think, why shouldn't I look different? You know, and that is sort of the beauty of this show, is that there is no judgment on these characters. You know, you sense that any one of them at any point could kind of change, go into a new direction, and that's not like... Jennifer mentioned that Otis is a dick a lot of times this season. And I don't think that's inconsistent with his character. I'm like, even like his mother says in season one, he's like, you're 16. There's nothing wrong with you. You're just a 16-year-old. You're still figuring this all out. And that allows for some really big shifts for some of these folks. We also have the Amy Lee Wood, who is kind of the sweet, ditzy, a mean girl who then ends up becoming friends again with Maeve, because, you know, she realizes she doesn't want to be a mean person, and she's always been kind of portrayed as kind of a very kind and but dim-witted, and she has one of the best storylines this season, which I didn't know where it was going. She basically has some guy on the bus masturbate on her. And she's shocked by this, and they kind of play it for a laugh. You know, she seems more...
Not really for a laugh.
Not a laugh at first, but she seems to downplay it. Like, she seems more upset that her favorite jeans were ruined. But Maeve is the one who's like, no, you were assaulted. You need to report this. And she's like, no, it's fine. It's not a big deal. And yet, with each episode, she starts suffering more and more from trauma, which leads towards a scene I'm not going to talk too much about. Let's just say there's a very long but well-appreciated homage to The Breakfast Club late in the season, where, you know, she gets the support she needs. And that's one of those things that this show does really well, because, yes, they can do these things in a very sort of light, humorous way. I mean, she's not raped. We don't see anything really horrific. You know, they never show, but they don't.
She's very important. She's a very important character. Yeah,
don't undersell it. Is what I'm trying to say. They don't disregard it.
She's an important character because she's openly like one of the first characters they openly objectified in the first episode of the show. So it's very important to give her like an important storyline this season. Sorry, you go ahead.
No, you're right.
No, it's okay. I'm going to take a completely different tack from your take on that particular storyline, because it's actually very indicative of a sexual abuse environment, kind of a denial of the situation it's like a shock from a trauma situation.
Fair.
So it's easier to focus on something quantifiable in that situation, like my jeans are dirty, what's going to happen to my jeans, than it is to actually emotionally unpack a trauma or an abuse that's happened, especially when it's in such a situation that's uncontrollable. And I actually found it to be some really elegant storytelling in the way that they unpacked that situation. I know many people who have been through abuse situations, and the story is always that it's very hard to unpack at the beginning. It's hard to admit that it happened, or to recognize how big or how important that was. And it's not until much farther down the road that you're able to actually, like I said, unpack that and then move on from it. So her story arc and the fact that it took such a long time for that to get there for her like the her breakdown at the end of that episode when it actually happened, and the her just needing to get away from her mom and then like freak out on her own is so indicative of what those situations are really like. Like, I had a very visceral response to that storyline in the show. And then the way that it, like you said, it resurfaces later with the group and how she was finally able to let go of that situation and really come to terms with it and admit that it had happened and how much it affects her was some really beautiful and relevant storytelling for our generation. It's where it finally in a generation where people are starting to be more active in reporting situations like that and having not only the advocate, like her friend, making her report it and telling her it was okay and physically holding her hand the whole time, but then helping her to work through it later. And then the group of girls that all kind of gathered around her to protect her and cushion her and help her work through a very real PTSD was such an important piece of storytelling that I'm hoping will help other people make those connections and work through elements like that as well. I can't stress the importance enough of expressing situations like that in media well and showing people what can happen and what support can be like and how to move through that. That's my TED Talk. Thank you for being here for it.
I am so glad you gave me that piece of context. Because
do you want 5 more minutes or anything?
I mean, I could give you 30.
I think, well, actually, it's worth talking about, but I think we're going to end up going into spoiler territory if we talk too much about it. I just wanted to say that that's some really good context because my initial reaction watching that moment was kind of similar to Maeve, where I'm like, I was offended on behalf of that character and wondering like, well, why aren't you making more of a deal about this? Why aren't you speaking up? And why aren't you comprehending it? But looking at it through the lens of like, of someone who's going through shock, that suddenly snaps that into place. Because I actually thought for a while, did they just introduce that storyline just to drop it? But they just seed it throughout, because I can't stress this enough. There are so many characters with so many subplots, and they do a really good job of just threading them throughout each episode. Season one focused a lot, I felt, on Otis's therapy sessions with the students. And it was kind of like I know it's a binge show, not a weekly show, but it kind of felt like, you know, this week's case, you know, the case.
Yeah, it was very segmented.
Yeah, it was like,
as opposed to like this fluid long-term storytelling they did this season. Oh, I totally agree on that.
Because it was like, this is the problem this week. We're going to solve this kid's problem. And by the end of the episode, we're going to have a little bit of resolution. We're also going to continue the other storylines. Here, now that Jean, Otis's mom, is at the school and offering sex advice, we find out that, you know, Maeve and Otis are losing clients, but we're also spending less time with those individual students, partly because Jean can kind of solve their problems a lot faster than Otis can. Big surprise, you know. If you're a sex therapist and you're a teenager and your only competition is, you know, a trained, licensed professional who's been doing this longer than you've been alive, she's going to be better at it.
And she's free.
And she doesn't charge.
And she's free.
Yeah, she's that's the other thing. It raises the ethics of what Otis is doing. Although, obviously, she charges for her services.
Well, Otis is a valuable source because it is the input of another teenager. His mom's approach is great. It should always be followed, but it's very much a detached approach too.
Right, which is of course one of the great through lines through both seasons, which is Jean is great dealing with other people's problems and keeping a distance, but you know, when it's her own son, there's some lines that get blurred very quickly, and you can see later on, and I really like that they bring the father back, because you really see how he also helped contribute to how fucked up Otis is. Because Otis, you know, if you saw season one, you knew the big climax, literally the climax of season one, was Otis finally learning how to masturbate. And I'm not going to tell... And this one... And boy, has he taken to it when this series starts. I won't even go through all of that, because you deserve to... That's almost like a little movie in itself. Like, just this little music video all dedicated to a kid's penis.
That's just what you weren't going into it.
You know, it's...
But for 1 second, guys, in all seriousness, for 1 second, for all the growing listeners, just one thing. Do not dry rub. It is not good for you.
Also, not in your mom's car.
Not in a car, not in public, not
to just, each their own.
You know, there is a time and a place for everything. And granted, when you're a teenager with erections, your erection is not respective of social functions or proper context. But as a grown-up, you have to deal with it. And that's what so much of this story is about. It's like going like, look, yeah, these things happen and they're embarrassing and they're awkward, but you have to learn how to handle yourself in those situations. And rather than making fun of you for having those problems, it does make fun of you for having those problems, but then it helps you through it as well. And of course you have Eric who absolutely loves the fact that Otis can finally get an erection and can finally whack off, but is constantly going to make fun of him for it. That's really, to me, the best relationship in the show, is this totally platonic relationship between these two best friends who are emotionally intimate, but, you know, not sexually intimate. And I really think that's kind of refreshing, because they don't play that card of like, at no point does Eric ever come out and tell Otis, you know, you're always the person I've had a crush on. It doesn't come into that. It's like these two guys can tell each other anything, and because they don't have that kind of awkward sexual tension, they can be very honest with each other and constantly take the piss out of one another. And it just makes for a very warm, very, very intriguing relationship that you don't see, because usually, I mean, you know, dudes are usually not very communicative and understanding when dealing with their friends, especially when you're a bunch of immature teenagers. At least that's been my experience.
Whenever they got into like little fights, it's like, come on, you all love each other.
Yeah.
Stop it.
They're, apart from Maeve, that's the one person you want Otis to get with. You know, you're like, come on, you guys belong together, you're buds, you'll get over it. You know, I feel like because we're so trying to avoid spoilers, you know, we've been kind of dancing around some of this. And I certainly want to be able to talk a little more freely. We're like over 20 minutes into this already. So maybe we should just start moving into final thoughts. And then we can kind of be a little more forthcoming in our conversation. So, Doggett, what did you think about this season?
This is a very excellent season of a show. Good job, Netflix. Good job, everybody. This is a great show. I wish we had this kind of informational show when we were younger. All I learned was in Degrassi, don't even bother doing the Magnum condoms. They'll just fall off. That's all I learned.
Well, I hope you learned a few more things since. What's your rating on this?
For this thing? Ooh, damn. I'm going to give this a... 10 out of 10 times, you better believe Otis masturbated a shitload of times this episode.
Okay. Well, that is definitely true. Jennifer, what say you?
This show is incredibly relevant, incredibly poignant, incredibly funny, well executed, elegant. There were several moments where I was incredibly uncomfortable. I really enjoy this. I enjoy the characters, I enjoy the development, and I love the fact that they're unpacking so many really critical things that people don't talk about enough that need to get talked about. So I'm going to give it a 9.75 Tank Girl Fantasies.
Later on, I'll be curious to find out what you took a quarter of a point off for.
Nobody gets a 10.
You know, there you go.
I have a story about that.
Fair enough, you know? Because then they'll just start expecting them all the time. That's not fair to anybody. I suspect I might be a little older than you guys. And when I grew up on a diet of like teen comedies, romantic comedies, teen sex comedies, everything along that spectrum. And let me tell you, those in the 1980s, they were really popular. And those are the kind of films that, to a large degree, Sex Education is riffing off of. And yet, those films of the past, they haven't aged well. a lot of them are really junk, and even some of the better ones, even like stuff by like John Hughes, by today's standards, they would be problematic at best, you know. But so I kind of wrote off this genre a long time ago. I thought that's junk. They can't ever make good ones. They're just trash. And in the past few years, we've been getting a lot of good ones. I mean, everything from Eighth Grade to Lady Bird to Booksmart to there was a French film, I think, La Morfou. There was, we saw one not too long ago that was, or Booksmart was the one I rewatched recently. And, you know, it just goes on and on and on. Even stupid stuff like Blockers, they're cheesy, raunchy sex comedies. But they actually have a heart, and they're smart, and they're witty, and they're actually talking about real things. Whereas the ones that I grew up on were basically just about the male gaze, and were kind of pervy and schlocky. And I don't think it's a mistake that most of those films I mentioned are written and directed, and usually center around females. And it seems like the ladies have taken that genre out of the, you know, crappy little filthy man cave and brought it out into the light and made it relevant for the modern era. And like Doggett was saying, you know, I kind of wish we had this stuff when I was a kid, even though it's very jokey and funny, and it's no replacement for, like, you know, real information. It gives you enough information that you can go, hey, I know where to start looking. You know, it kind of helps you feel better about yourself and says it's okay to go look this stuff up. Go read some more books. There's a lot more information out there, but you get it in little bite-sized chunks all throughout this series. And I think, like Jennifer was saying, it probably is going to be very helpful for some people who are going through various issues, whether you've been through a traumatic sexual assault, or you're disabled and haven't seen yourself represented on screen, or you have questions about how do you get the morning after pill, things of this nature. And for that, I have to give it a lot of credit. I give this 9 out of 10 extremely improbable, highly expensive productions of Romeo and Juliet that no high school could ever afford to put on.
Right? It was basically a manga.
I was right, like, though? I did high school theater. I've done theater as an adult. That's like, you just spent $500,000 on that show. That's impossible.
We're in Texas. You've seen little high school productions that went that far. Come on, be honest.
Not to, like, you know, actually decorate the house
in
and the
Texas,
boxes.
In Austin, Texas, you are going to lie to me and say you've never seen a high school production like that.
No. Not where you actually have, like, neon, like an enormous neon cock-shaped catwalk and, you know, like, tentacles draped all around the balconies. We don't have balconies in those theaters. Also, I don't go to high school. I don't have kids. So why the hell would I be in a high school? Well, I did briefly date a teacher who was... So I did go see one or two productions, but I assure you, they were not that elaborate. And on that note, let us move into the spoiler section, because here's where the fun starts. We've been talking for over 30 minutes, because I know we've talked about all the things that are good, but have been kind of purposefully vague. Jennifer, highlight of the season for you, is there something that just jumps out at you?
Ooh, why you gotta put me on the spot like that?
Because I've talked enough.
I don't know. Come back to me. I got to think about this. You can't rush perfection.
Well, I guess some people can't take the heat. I'm pretty quick already.
All right.
So I'm going to say Otis lost his virginity. That's pretty important.
There you go. You know, it's like finally. And isn't it great, like, when he finally happens? He doesn't even remember it.
It's the best illustration of it, because it really comes down to, it really doesn't matter.
Yeah, and I thought that was going to be like a nightmare scenario with Ruby the mean girl, and she's like, oh my god, and you know, I hate you. And it turns out they end up, I don't know if they're like best buds or friends, but they have obviously been through an experience together.
She's human.
And they deal with it. You know, they deal with it rationally.
He manned up. He paid for the morning after pill.
Well, yeah, you know, but I love that detail.
With our condom.
She sends him to go get it, and she's like, no, your girlfriend has to come in here and do it. And I'm like, oh, that's a good detail. That makes sense, you know. And obviously, it's Britain. They have a free health care system. Maybe it sure made it seem a lot easier. I don't know if it's that easy for women in this country to get that kind of treatment. Not over the counter, anyway. But yeah, what do you feel about the character of Isaac? Because I think he's kind of the real monkey wrench here this season.
Isaac. That's the repairman, right?
No. Isaac is Maeve's neighbor who has a crush on her. Wheelchair dude.
Oh, wheelchair bastard. I want to roll him down a hill.
You know, but I like that they kind of like show it. Like, he's a dick. But you also realize why he's a dick.
You. Why are you watching me?
You know, yeah, but he's like, you know, I don't trust your mom. I know that woman's sketchy because my mom was sketchy and all of this stuff. And then, of course, by the end, you know, you realize he's a scam artist and he's not above, like, playing the, oh, I'm in a wheelchair, won't you please help me? And then, you know, laughing about it later. It adds a little complexity. He's not just a victim. But this is what I'm talking about with the love triangle thing, because from season one, they really, really want you to root for Otis and Maeve to get together. And a lot of TV shows have done that will they, won't they kind of dynamic over several seasons. And I always get tired of it after a while because it seems more organic. By this point, they should just be together, whereas the writers have to keep coming up with contrivances to keep them apart. And I'm getting a little tired because obviously now we're back to square one and season three is going to be more. I really hope season one, episode one, he goes, did you get my message? What message? The one I told you how great and awesome you were. She's like, huh, I guess I don't. You know, instead of like waiting half a season to find that out.
Marcos, you know what show you signed up for. There's nothing but fake. There's nothing but 30-year-olds trying to be teenagers here.
I know. I guess. Isn't it enough that they are irresponsible and silly and teenager? Can't they just every once in a while go, you know, why don't we do this rationally?
That's always the advice at the end is like, well, talk to your partner about this.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many things. Like, in the season one, you know, Maeve's like, I'm going to go tell Otis I love him, but he's already back with Alla. And then here, he's the one who sends the message to her, but Isaac intercepts it because she conveniently left her phone.
The first half of the season was me patiently waiting for Otis to fuck up.
Well, it didn't have to wait that long. No. Otis fucks up every episode in some way, but yeah.
In his relationship.
Oh, yeah, well, I mean, that reaches ahead at the party, which, you know, we didn't even touch on in the spoiler-free section. The party, I think, is one of the highlights where Otis has that rite of passage where it's like, teenage party. This is cliche trope 101 right out of every teen movie ever.
And the chicken.
Oh my god.
Oh, that was god, that whole thing.
And then he selfishly ate it all.
He ate it all, and then
he got his own cup. He got laid. He won that night, if we're gonna think about it.
Well, yeah. Oh, but is it really winning? I mean, you pissed off both of the women who liked you. You ended up sleeping with a woman you didn't give a shit about. And your whole day, the next day was...
And you basically had non-consensual sex because you were drunk.
And the next day, your whole day is all about like, well, I guess we have to go to the pharmacy and try to get a morning after pill. It's kind of a drag. And I do like that he addresses that. He's like, did I consent? She's like, yes, you gave consent. You gave so much consent, you wouldn't shut up about it. So even drunk Otis is still not a total bastard. But yeah, it was one of those things that was so smart because unlike so many other characters who were just desperately trying to lose their virginity, he lost it and it's like, it's over. It's like he ripped the Band-Aid off and he can kind of move on from there. Because that's really... A lot of people put so much pressure on themselves that first time out, and part of it is just getting it fucking over with. Even his own dad, who's like, we finally acknowledge, is acknowledged as a, you know, a sex addict, says, look, your first time's not going to be any good. It's one of those things where it's like, I can't believe that there's a show that can do this, that can be as funny as it is, and then always come back around to like, Here's the message. Here's what you need to know in order to go forward. And you didn't get that kind of shit in my day. They were always just kind of crude jokes. Every once in a while you might get a little heartfelt moment. But yeah, nothing as daring as this. This is such a breath of fresh air. And now we have a lot of dead air.
I'm sorry, I'm all introspective now. I'm just thinking about the entirety of this.
Well, I'm just curious about Adam and his dad's relationship.
Yeah.
Would his dad care if he was gay? I feel like if he came out to him, he'd be like, okay, get a job.
Well, at this point, maybe, because Adam is clearly fucked up in a lot of ways. And that's the character that I always thought he was just like a joyless fuckboy. And now you do sympathize. It's again talking about things that take a long time to pay off. I'm like, why are we spending time with this miserable sad sack character, this poor kid? You understand what he's going through, but he has one single expression. He's just constantly scowling, and every time we go back into his home, we go, oh, I see where you get this. You're just as uptight and repressed as your dad is, and now you're sick of it. Your mom is sick of it. I mean, that was great also, because we don't give enough attention, I think, in this show sometimes to how good the adults are and how they have their own problems and hang-ups that they're dealing with. Gene is the obvious focus, but even guys
no,
like
the
Yakov
mom
or
is
the doctor,
such a great
yeah.
Man, that's such a great
Mrs.
arc.
Groff is
that's
great.
Such a rarity to have somebody who's been with a partner, even in a loveless marriage, for that long, but who's got a practically adult kid. To actually get the stones up to tell him, like, you know what? This situation isn't enough for me. I'm going to reinvent myself, reinvent my life. I'm leaving you. We're getting a divorce. No, I'm not taking you back. Get your shit together. Get a life. But then when she later comes back and has that great conversation with Adam, where she shows that it's not even just about her moving on. She completely understands her partner for what he was. Like, he should have fought for us forever, but he's so afraid of showing any emotion ever that he never fought for us. And she's right, like, that is unacceptable, and that is something that you can't move through. And I think it was her admission of that and them finally communicating as a family that finally kind of broke the seal for Adam to get over his dad and get over his dad's hang-ups and then start to actually show emotion and become more full and in himself and then actually go after Eric. And that was a really good arc. 3/4 of the season, I was not wanting any of that business to happen, and I was yelling at the TV screen at Eric every time he gave him the time of day. And I'm not necessarily happy that the two of them would be together. When they came at each other at the party and Eric laid him out, I was like, yes, this is the closure we need in this situation. Move on, let Adam go and move on with your happiness, but that will also get Adam to move on and become a person. And then they went back to it and I was disappointed, but that moment was like, yes, this is closure, this is a loop, yes.
And Raheem kind of got screwed.
Sorry, go ahead.
No. I mean, I was just saying that the Raheem character, I felt shortchanged because he's like,
he did. Raheem was great.
He was too nice and we all know it.
Was he, what are you saying, he's like secretly a serial killer or something?
You are now, but if you spent more than like, okay, stop being so patient, goddammit.
You know,
he was beautiful, and I particularly...
Have you ever tried being that patient? People hate it when you're that patient.
Well, you know, I did like the one moment, and I agree with Jennifer that I was kind of waiting for like, will we please just cut this off, because clearly this is a toxic relationship. And when he finally just tells him, like, I can't be with a guy who doesn't love himself. It's like, you were a bully. You were terrible to me. You know, I can't just let all that go. And even if I could, until you learn to love yourself, how could I ever love you? I mean, because he's so fucking miserable. I got tired of his, like, scowly face. The only time he lit up was when he was breaking things, which I do love that callback, though. And of all people, he gets to hang out with Alla and takes her over there. And he's like, they start going to that junkyard and smashing shit. And she feels so much better, which, of course, culminates in Amy and her squad all getting a lot of tension out by just destroying a car. I'm like, that was so cathartic.
Tell me one of the most heartwarming moments of the show wasn't the hug at the end.
The hug. The hug was absolutely everything. When Ola told him that she cared about him and loved him as a friend, and he just, like, the realization on his face, and he, like, tackle hugs her, that was so beautiful. I loved that.
You could see look on his face was, friend?
Yeah, like, what is that?
Best friend? What?
He's, That he's like so Frankenstein. Good. I loved that. Mm, friend, good. Yeah, when he finally meets Eric's parents, or at least his mom, and, you know, he kind of, like, I think, smiles for a second. But again, I just didn't believe that there was any real choice there other than they had decided that's where it was going. It's like, what was the worst thing about Remy is he went to church and he was like, eh, I'm not really religious. I mean, there's no indication that Adam is.
Hey, Eric likes white guys. Let's just get over it. Eric likes white guys.
But the fact that Raheem was willing to go to church with his partner, knowing that he was an atheist and wasn't interested in religion, but he was so about learning his partner and learning his perspective, that was a really beautiful and incredibly rare moment. And then he was worried that he had offended the pastor for not reciprocating the faith. That was a really unique moment.
Yeah, and that goes back to even to season one. I think the thing I like so much about the character of Eric is that we've seen this story so many times where a gay character is struggling with his sexuality. He comes from a religious background. In this case, he's part of an ethnic minority that is traditionally very conservative. All of those things, you go, I already know where this plot is going. And yet, time and time again, they thwart it. It's not a religious thing. His father just cares for him and doesn't want him to get hurt. And then later on, we realize that actually, religion is a very big part of who Eric is. His faith is very important to him. And it's not something he plans to turn his back on. And he behaves differently in church because he respects his religion. Raheem even mentions, like, you're different here. He's like, well, yeah, I'm in church. And usually in a story where there'd be a gay character and, you know, is kind of dealing with repression, you know, they would demonize that. I mean, this ain't Footloose where the priest is telling, you know, people to stop dancing. And it's like, no, it's actually okay. And I'm not a very religious person at all. But I do like seeing that trope circumvented and done in a little bit differently. They're like, oh no, it's not this screed about, like, right-wing religious people. It's like, no, this character can still have a lot of faith and still embrace his sexuality and be gay and still have a loving, supportive family. He doesn't have to choose one over the other. So it seemed really weird that they brought Raheem in there just to go, huh. It seemed like they were setting that up to be, like, the thing that was going to be, like, the wedge between them, and they didn't really explore that. He ultimately goes back to Adam, a guy who
beat him up.
Yeah!
I've never been a fan of that trope that I've been seeing since, like, 2010. The bully-turned-lover. I've never enjoyed this.
Yeah.
I feel like it added a little bit of sexual tension to my bullies. Like there's a part of, like, where they got me in the head, like, is this the part where we kiss?
Yeah, well, I never had any kind of bullies that ever reciprocated in that way. Usually they were more happy to just stick to wedgies and cruel words. But, you know, bullies are like anybody else. You know, you punch them in the face once and they leave you alone. That's the great thing about bullies. They're not very strong-minded people. And as we see, Eric is very... not Eric, but Adam is a very weak, broken man-child who's stunted. And I'm like, why would you go with this dude who's so broken and so not capable of reciprocating any affection? But who knows? Maybe he's turned a new leaf. Can we talk a bit in more detail about that goddamn production of Romeo and Juliet, because that's Broadway quality level. That would be the hottest ticket in town if that show actually existed.
It looked like a basic UIL show. I agree.
UIL
show. I feel like
show.
Being a fly on the wall in the pitch for this season of the show would have been the best part of the show. Like, wait. So we're going to have this whole season where we develop all these characters, yada, yada, yada. And then 45 minutes into the pitch, he's like, and then the last episode, the play, which you find out is really just all about penis. Many penis, peni everywhere. And then Silver LeMay.
Are you afraid that her relationship with, I'm sorry, what's the ex-girlfriend's name?
Ola,
are you afraid that's a phase for her?
Probably.
No, not at all.
I don't know. I mean, you know, one thing that the show doesn't ever really acknowledge, and I understand why they're not going to, but you're dealing with characters who are teenagers, And like I said, so much of this whole season, this whole series seems to be about getting Otis and Maeve together. And I don't think anybody's had the conversation about how brief the average teenage romance really is. It's like, dude, even if you get her, that you guys aren't getting married. You're not going to live together for the rest. You're not going to die together and have a family. You know?
How dare you ruin my happily ever after aspersions? How dare you?
I feel that way now watching the end of Ferris Bueller's Day Off, where, you know, Mia Sarrow's looking at it.
Saved by the Bell. We'll see who's still together or not.
You know,
wow.
It's one of those things where it's like, I do kind of wish they would touch on that, because, again, when you're young and in love, and hell, even when you're older, you kind of feel like, oh, this is the most important thing ever. This is huge. This is my priority. This is my entire life is going to be impacted by this relationship. When in reality, like, well, that was a fun 18 months. You know, it's, and that's even exacerbated when you're a teenager, I think. And for us to kind of be rooting for those kids, I mean, did you read Romeo and Juliet? I mean, come on. That didn't end well for anybody. Those just some horny 14-year-olds who didn't know what to do.
It's an awful story.
It's not very good.
I didn't know that the parents had insurance on the kids, actually.
You know, and the thing is, it ends kind of the same way in that it's about a message that doesn't get delivered in time. Or in this case, it's intercepted by Isaac and deleted. It's like the love that gets ruined because a piece of information doesn't get to another person at the right time. And also,
it's kind of a comedy, you know, at the very end. It's like, it is. Ah, you dumb teenagers.
Kind of, sort of. I mean, I guess if you do it right. But I love the fact that we knew all season long they were doing Romeo and Juliet. And, you know, we knew that, you know, there was going to be a band, and that Lily was directing or somehow involved. And the way they managed to keep that under wraps until that final episode, and you're like, what the fuck is this? I mean, I really thought it was like, okay, it's going to be a conventional production of Romeo and Juliet. And
I don't know what you're talking about. Every penis on that stage, she drew throughout this season.
I mean, yeah, but I didn't expect to see them all in one place with, you know, that big of a budget. I mean, Lily, by the way, is great. I think she's the most over-the-top character, but the actress who does it is so good at it, at this sort of deadpan insanity that is Lily. And I'm like, why didn't I meet that girl in high school? Because that girl is a freak, but also extremely cool. And again, a storyline that I didn't see coming. It's really just full of surprises, the way it throws all these tropes together and finds fresh new ways to twist them around. And yeah, you know, guys, I think we are past the 50-minute mark, if you can believe it. We've been talking a long time, and I think most people have already turned us off. If you're listening this, if you're still listening, thank you.
We're just so passionate.
Yeah, I mean, we're running out of time, but we couldn't run out of things to say because there's so many other subplots and characters and themes and storylines and gags that we haven't even touched on. This is a very rich, very rewarding show, in my opinion. Any more final thoughts, guys, before we wrap it up?
I'm good. I said my piece.
Seriously, guys, use lube.
Doggett is very, very serious
adamant
about that.
About this point.
He knows of what he speaks. Good night.